Monday, February 24th.
In February already.
We're in the final the final week? Yeah.
It is a leap year, but this is LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier. We've got Alyssa Walker here. It's just the two of us today. Hayes is unfortunately out of commission. He is sick, so we are going to be holding it down, just the two of us. How are you doing, Alyssa?
I'm not sick.
Me neither. And I'm actually happy if I can keep it that way this flu season, if I can make it through
this
unscathed
coronavirus season.
Yeah, there's that too. I haven't been quarantined in any windowless rooms, so I feel like I'm ahead of the curve.
I haven't been on any cruises yet. Probably pretty cheap to go if you want to go.
We have a bunch of big stuff to cover this week. Do we want to get started with some LA stories, though?
Yeah. I was gone a lot of the week, so you might have more LA in your story than mine.
That is true. My LA story is about the Metro Bike system, which I've been actually getting more and more comfortable with using. These are like the docked. They have stations all around central LA, more and more.
The ones on the west side don't have stations. They're smart bikes.
I haven't even been over to the west side since they started doing it.
North Hollywood and the west side both have dockless ones. But
yeah,
go on.
I don't know how they, have you used them?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either. And I don't know how they work, but I am getting more and more familiar with the central LA bike share system and I'm enjoying it. I took a regular Metro bike up to Los Feliz from my house the other day. It's great. One of the things that I am growing like frustrated with is that they like got me hooked on the e-bike, the electric bike,
yes.
Which are, for if you've never used an electric bike before, they're really cool because you just like press the little power button and it gives you like a little boost. So you are like exerting yourself less and going faster. I still feel like the regular Metro bikes are pretty heavy and I'm not super fond of them in general. But yeah, so these electric bikes are really convenient. And ever since the first time that I rode them, I've been like, I don't know. I'm like defaulting to that now and I can never find them. And it's like all I want. So I actually spent some time this weekend. Of course, it's Ciclovia this weekend. First one of the year they did in South LA in like Watts. And I was just like, where are these things? Where are they actually? So I went through, I used the Metro Bike Share app, which tells you like these are a list of all the stations and how many bikes they have right now. And I went through and I counted all of the bikes at the station. And I feel so bad. I have to like apologize to Metro because like this is what happens when you get me interested in your service.
So you have like real-time data or you actually physically went through
each? They have a list.
Yeah, the little counters.
And they have a list of stops. And for each line, it says 12 bikes.
Oh, you can look at it all as like a spreadsheet? Yeah. Oh, so I would just click on the map. I would just be like...
Just as a list. It's not a spreadsheet. It's just a list in the app. And I just like counted them all up. And so there are like 1,000 bikes, right? In the entire like central LA area. And of those, only 38 are electric bikes. So your odds of finding an electric bike actually are like very small. It is as unlikely as it seems when you're just like walking around. And that's unfortunate. I posted this on Twitter and some people, Robbie Abenora, the NRDC, formerly worked at Metro. He mentioned that one of the big challenges for Metro in deploying these bikes is that they need to like send people out to charge them.
Swap the batteries. They actually just pull the battery out, put a new battery in.
And replace it. So that charging element is still, I was kind of surprised by that because I feel like they have the solar panel, right?
I think that's the next step. That has to power the little hub. So if you walk up and use
the kiosk.
Oh, okay. But I think what's smart though is that this started as a pilot program. I thought it was more than 36 or whatever. They just threw some bikes in to see how it went. And I think what they'll start doing is that as they turn over the bikes, they'll just replace them with electric. I mean, why wouldn't they? I think that's like the best use of the bike share service. So I figure they'll start pulling them out.
Those electric bikes. I still find it very scary most of the time when I'm biking around LA, but the electric bikes for a 2 mile or whatever ride. Yeah. It's super convenient.
It just makes you feel more confident and it makes you feel like you can keep up with cars in a way that doesn't make you as scared to be traveling next to them.
Honestly, it makes feel a lot closer to the neighborhoods around you. Mm-hmm. You know, like going from like Koreatown to Silver Lake does not feel that far on an electric bike. So cool. Get more of them. Let's see how that works.
And related, the Jump bikes are back around town, as you might have seen.
That?
So Uber and the city of LA have been going through like a series of lawsuits. Mm-hmm. Like, remember, Uber was mad about data. They didn't want real-time data shared from their bikes.
Yeah.
The city kind of pushed back and said, well, if you don't give us the data, you can't deploy here. And then a recent settlement is in favor of Uber, but then there's another settlement coming up. And there was a story in City Lab that Laura Bliss wrote recently this week, which is there's all these like micromobility data nerds out there on Twitter that, you know, read the story and chimed in. But it's basically like a battle between Uber and the city of LA, which because I think Uber is pretty scared that it will eventually come to LA asking, well, now we have to find out data about your flying cars and your autonomous vehicles and all your other things that you plan to deploy.
So the jump bikes, these are the ones where you can just sort of like park them anywhere. They're dockless,
yes,
like the smart
ones.
Bikes we were talking about earlier. Yeah. Owned by Uber. And the city of LA was setting requirements for any micromobility
that all the other
providers
ones do and without a complaint.
And Uber said that it was jeopardizing for the privacy of users. I see.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I just remember like they were everywhere. And I know you and Hayes were riding them around, and then they were
gone.
Gone
I
completely.
Thought they were just pulling out, but they were just maybe throwing a tantrum. But now they're back, and they're a bit around. I mean, I can't say they're everywhere they used to be, but they're definitely popped up back in my neighborhood again.
Really can't rule out Uber throwing a tantrum. They're doing that about AB5 still, an ongoing thing where the worker misclassification law that went into effect in January, Uber is still going through the process of changing their service so that they will not have to pay their workers minimum wage, basically, or give them benefits. So that is, I feel like, always a distinct possibility that they're throwing a tantrum.
Right. And it's, like I said, none of the other micromobility companies are complaining. They're just doing it. And I think the city, you have to think that the city is going to have your data and your privacy concerns in mind more than possibly Uber, I would say.
I would be shocked if Uber were actually the only actor in this space that cared about personal privacy of its users. I would be very, very surprised.
But then the other thing is like you said, if you ride like one of those smart bikes, Metro bike, smart bike, they're tracking your data. They need to know where the bike is. The city owns that data and has all the information. So I really don't understand how anyone could be upset or trying to say that like this is an unreasonable thing when it's like, we should know where those things are. We should know where people are going with them. We should know, and we should know just so we can make better decisions as a city. So I understand there were some privacy concerns because they say, you know, your home, you'll drop off a bike near your home or something like that. But then don't drop off the bike right by your house.
Honestly,
I don't know.
Though, but like all of the data can and is depersonalized anyway.
They
which
say
is,
that, but there was concern. You know, I think there's a lot of people who are concerned, like if the city owns this information on you. But then there's been so many other things. Like, didn't Metro use like cell phone data to collect information on bus ridership to like make its new? There was a big story in Wired about that. So like, there's so many other ways to track people, and there's so many other ways to. A license plate reader will read your license plate when you go into a parking garage. Like, I mean,
if you think that the city of Los Angeles doesn't know where you live, I mean, not exactly sure what to tell you.
I mean, I understand there are concerns about privacy data. Get it, all that stuff. But I mean, if you are personally concerned about these things, like maybe don't drop the bike off right in front of your house or the scooter, like put it on the corner. I don't know. It's like we have to understand where these things are and what the impact is to make better decisions as a city. So
if you are doing like a freegan invasion style, that's your living arrangement. You're probably not doing a jump bike anyway.
Or maybe you are.
Maybe you are, but I doubt it. Okay, Alyssa, do you have an LA story?
Well, mine is about a slightly larger impact than just finding a great electric bike on my corner. Mine is about appliances and the status kitchen that we have set up for ourselves. And I don't think I talked about this on the show, but my fridge broke, and it took us a while to notice, because I think when you're like just busy parents, you just don't notice. And all of a sudden our kitchen like really smelled. And then we were like, oh yeah, I think it's broken. And it turns out it couldn't be fixed, and I would have to get rid of my fridge and get a new fridge, which just made me devastated. Yeah. Because not just because it costs money, but like we're throwing something out that was not even that old, and having to replace it with another wasteful, you know, hunk of stainless steel. But what I found out, and I wrote a story about it on Curbed about my journey here, was there's good and bad things about this. And some of it is related to, you know, what the city of LA is doing, which is what I'll get to in a second. But your fridge is like the most energy intensive appliance mm-hmm. in your house. Mm-hmm. If you think about anything else that you have, people like probably worry more about certain things, but your fridge is on all the time.
All the time.
It
yeah.
never turns off. And it also has things like ice makers and ice dispensers and all these other things that are not only also energy intensive, but also, you know, can break really easily. So mm-hmm. you might have like a fridge that you have these cool, or they also have these smart fridges, like all this stuff now, right? So all that stuff is just garbage. Like yeah. I'm trying, you know, trying to think around that and just the cooling of your food. And what's really concerning about fridges right now is that they're getting bigger and bigger, like anything else. It's like an SUV.
Yeah.
And they are getting more energy efficient, like car. You know, it's very much like cars. Yeah. That like they're getting more energy efficient and
on
like
on the margins.
On the margins, yeah. right? So the fridge that we were throwing out, our new fridge is actually like twice as efficient if you think mm-hmm. about it. So we did end up, you know, buying one, and I'll go into that in a second. But so you do end up, you know, you should get a newer fridge because it's more efficient, but you have no choice but to get one that is gigantic
yeah.
because they're so big. So I ended up talking to my friend Nikki Twilley, who is a refrigeration expert. She's writing a book about the cold chain.
That's amazing.
Which is this network that keeps our food cold from basically the moment it's like picked or produced till we get to our door.
Wow.
Because even things that you don't even refrigerate at home, things like bananas, which you bring to your house and let them ripen at home, uh-huh. have to be kept cold the entire time they get to you or at a certain
spoil.
Temperature. Even things that you know, you think of that you're just like, oh, I might not even, you know, need to keep that cold. The manufacturer of them, like all the ingredients need to be kept, all these mm-hmm. things. So that is one of the greatest concerns for climate reasons, because not only because of the energy of powering basically this fleet of refrigerators and growing size to get yeah. this to you and store all the food, but also because refrigerants themselves, like the chemicals that we use to put in these refrigerators and things like air conditioners, are called super greenhouse gases. So you've got like this very localized problem of, you know, yes, you're getting your food to you and it's horrible, but also these cold storage facilities are leaking and yeah. off-gassing, and you have your own fridge as part of this thing. So it's like very bad,
yeah,
like
totally.
Refrigerating all your food. And what I learned from the week that we were trying to get our fridge fixed, and then we had another week where we were waiting to get our new fridge, is that you should probably refrigerate a lot fewer things mm-hmm. and you should really think about where your food is coming from. I mean, we think about these things in like kind of the different way. I never thought about food waste as being my fridge is being part of the food waste problem. We know that food waste is such a big contributor to climate change, but we don't think about our own fridge. And the studies have shown the bigger your fridge is, the more likely
the more
you
food
are to
you
waste
food. Waste. That makes so much, like, I feel
it
like
does.
Just intuitively that makes so much sense, because it's like, you just are like, oh, well, I can just fill this space up with all of this stuff.
yeah.
I'm not going to
yeah.
use it.
That's exactly, I had this like thing go off in my head, but then we had this hole in our kitchen that was as big as this giant fridge.
Yeah.
So we had to either redesign our kitchen or buy a smaller fridge that would have like not quite fit. I don't know. It's like, this is the bigger problem that I wish I had thought of sooner.
Uh-huh.
And then the great thing about the city of LA, which I promised I'd circle back to, is two things. One is you can put your refrigerator out and they'll come and take it and do recycling off the curb. You know, I think uh-huh. probably everybody expects that. The other one is you can get a rebate through LADWP. And so you tell them what you bought, and mm-hmm. they do this for all sorts of appliances. So you or your landlord or whoever like does this, hopefully maybe you'll get it, the rebate if you're a landlord, but you just have to tell them what kind of model you bought or whatever. And they'll send you like a rebate, which is so great. So you have these incentives for upgrading, or if you do have to upgrade, that you, if you pick a more energy efficient model, they'll give you money.
I'm so like, I'm so curious about this, because like you said, my fridge and my apartment, my like one bedroom apartment, is enormous. I would say it takes up like a substantial part of my kitchen. It's so big. It is like the Escalade of fridges.
Yes.
I rent my apartment, so it's not like it was there when we moved in.
Most people, even if you buy a house, it's there when you moved in.
Okay.
That's like a thing, and which I didn't even understand.
It.
Yeah, they all often sell the appliances with the house.
I'm so curious. Like, it is like for, like you were saying, that your new one that you got is twice as efficient as the last one. But then at the same way, I don't know if you saw this on Twitter this week, there was like this, somebody posted I think it was a comparison of
a Volkswagen, like the diesel versus
yeah.
the electric car.
And
yeah.
how long it takes
right.
to actually like, quote unquote, pay off the
yeah.
initial cost, like environmental cost of building that new electric car. I wonder what the same graph would look like for these large appliances.
Because you're right, they're getting bigger. So you might have replaced an older one with something, but then you're going to get the bigger size. Apparently, they're very good at recycling a lot of the materials. And
that's good.
But a lot of it's like plastic. Like, I don't know what they do with that. It seems gross.
I will just say, like, too, like, if you have ever gone out of town for an extended period of time and you, like, come back and you get your DWP or whatever utility bill, you see like this lower than normal, but like solid plateau of energy usage. And that is all your fridge.
Yeah.
And it might be like a third of your energy consumption or something like that. So yeah, I've been looking at getting a smaller fridge. I have to figure out a way to navigate this with my landlord since it's not.
Show them the energy save. There's a calculator. There's an Energy Star calculator you can use to compare two models and it will show you your energy savings per year.
LA apartment living, it's like, it has to become more like a place like Tokyo, right? Where you have like a more of a culture of like small space living. And in LA, we have more of a culture of like, when things start getting too big for your space, you just get a larger space.
Or you get a storage space.
Or you get a storage space, which I was actually thinking about doing for my big Escalade fridge, just putting it in a storage space. But yeah, I mean, it definitely, we have to develop a culture of small space living here. And I feel like the kitchen is a good place to start.
I loved that article.
It was so good.
Oh, thank you. Well, hopefully I got some people thinking and undoing their McMansion kitchens. That will never happen, but you're right. I mean,
your HGTV kitchen dreams.
For small space living. So I was in Colorado Springs this week where it's basically a city built around the Olympics because the Olympic Training Center is there and they're building an Olympic museum in the downtown. They also have a bike share that's all electric bikes and it's very cute all over the downtown. Cool. But it was a great visit. Great to hear how they're kind of dealing with change as far as the things like the Olympic Museum coming to town, but also like growing and dealing with transportation challenges. And the day that I left, someone came to town to give He came from LA to give a rally that was very famous where he talked about how Parasite shouldn't have won the best film, shouldn't be a foreign language film or something. Anyway, but Trump also made an appearance here in LA related to the Olympics. So what did he say,
Scott? Oh, God. So Donald Trump came to town. We talked a little bit about this last week. This is a continuing source of consternation, not just for the three of us, but for, I think, a lot of Angelenos that are...
At least four more or five.
At least a handful more of Angelenos that our leaders, our civic leaders, continue to... Mayor Garcetti was on KTLA this past week saying that they asked him point blank. Donald Trump was here. He did a press conference with Casey Wasserman, head of the city's Olympic bid, and several of his staff and people from his administration. And he talked a lot about how the federal government was going to come into LA and take over the response to the homelessness crisis. And Mayor Garcetti's response is, I've been saying that I welcome anybody to this fight that wants to be here. It's happened again. It's happened once again. Donald Trump has come back to town in order to ostensibly give his blessing to the, I don't know what that means. He gave his pledge of federal support to the U.S. Olympics. No Olympics. We've had Ann Ortier on this show. She talked to us about the way that these federal events work. There is, since 2001 at least, there's been an operational agreement that goes into place for the Department of Homeland Security, nominally for national security. But that federal law enforcement, immigration was mentioned directly during this press conference, that they would have a much broader presence in the LA area. This is happening in a backdrop where we just talked about the president's desire to send BORTAC into our cities, this task force of Border Patrol agents with tanks and things. So it's concerning that nobody in city government really seems to take this seriously or seems to view that as something that is a cause for concern. But yeah, so Donald Trump came out here. He talked with Casey Wasserman, who was saying this No Olympics had a really kind of hard to watch clip that they posted on Twitter on their Twitter account that was like Casey Wasserman saying, the Olympics wouldn't be happening without you, sir. And it seems very bad. And it just like looks terrible. And it's like, we're going to save you a front row seat at the Olympics. It's just, it's not good. Then during the press questions from that, he fielded Donald Trump, that is, fielded a question from the media that was like, you've been really critical about the homeless situation here. What do you make of it? And Donald Trump is saying people are leaving LA and San Francisco and they're talking about how much Democrats have ruined these cities, and you just can't have that. And it's really the only thing that they have in common is the leadership. So it's up to the federal government, and we're going to put people in concentration camps. I don't know, like that seems
probably
like, that does seem like that's the thing. But we have, you know, Ben Carson was just in town, just here, talking about his experience working with Eric Garcetti. Garcetti was not present at the press conference that Donald Trump just had, but oh man, we are, I think, expecting. Ben Carson had told NPR he expects an announcement to be made about the deal that LA is making with the federal government very soon. Donald Trump, for his part, said that no other cities are currently working with the federal government. Only LA is. So we have that. What do you even think about that? It's like, we're the only city that is working with, the only Democratic run city that is working with Donald Trump to try and solve the homelessness crisis.
I think that sounds really troubling. And I also love like the mixed messages I get from our governor, who has said publicly that, you know, we want to help. And then every other email I get from the governor's office is like, we're suing Trump.
Yeah.
Over like, you know, different things like the fuel efficiency standards and immigration and you know, all these other things, clean air. There's literally like every week, the subject line is we're suing Trump. And even like, you know, I think the mayor even sparred a little bit with Trump on Twitter. Didn't he like give a little jab to him?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. He got so like
roasted in return.
Right. So I just don't understand why you would cooperate in any form, in any way, and then very publicly be like, we're suing you and you know, resist and we're running, literally backing people who are trying to take you out of office. It's just, I don't understand.
What is gained? I don't get what is gained. I don't get what would be the question that I have had for people who say, well, you know, he is the president and like, you can't just not talk to the president of the United States. My question to return is you can, right? You totally can. I mean, in the absence of a very compelling, I mean, maybe potentially even in the presence of evidence that it would cost the city something material, you might still be able to make the case that we shouldn't be doing it. But I haven't even seen the evidence for that put in front of me, where it's like, well, by not reaching our hand out and offering to shake Donald Trump's hand, that we might lose something. We might lose funding from HUD. We might lose, et cetera, et cetera. Like, the fact of the matter is the federal government has been paring back its role in local housing administration for decades, since the 70s. And Donald Trump is not going to be the person to turn that trend around, no matter how much he might like beg and plead. And it's demeaning to you personally as a politician, and it's demeaning to everybody who lives here, who is being victimized by Donald Trump's policies, to have our leaders like begging and bowing and scraping. And I can't stand it. Honestly.
Bad for morale. It's bad for, it's going to be, have lasting effects regardless of this election, the November election coming up, but it's going to have a lasting effects on, I think, everybody who's remains in office locally past that date, because this is a bad look, and this is, it's not going to end well.
Does the pragmatism, so does it, would it, do you think it means anything that like somebody like Eric Garcetti or Gavin Newsom, who we can talk a little bit about his state of the state too, he just had that this past week, but these are two people, like, as you mentioned, they keep saying, we want to work with the federal government. I have no idea why they keep saying this, but it seems like what they're trying to do is establish that Democrats are pragmatic.
Right.
And Garcetti had a line, I think maybe when he was talking at the USC event the other week,
right,
about how like, this is not the time for firing squads. This is the time for chilling choice of words, by the way. This is the time for us to reach out to all available partners, because, you know, words are not going to change what we need to do. We have to act together. Something to that effect.
Something like someone who is backing a moderate presidential candidate might say.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, sure. Joe Biden, who, as you've mentioned in the past, has no housing plan. I think that's still true.
It's still true.
Yeah. So who knows? But does that make sense to you? Like the argument from pragmatism, is that compelling?
I mean, that's one of the major arguments for Biden's campaign and other people who are running for president right now. Like, this is not the time. This is not the time. But yet, more than anything, I would say it probably is not the time to try to make friends with people that are so clearly not helping the state of this particular city in so many ways. Yeah, so it's anything to any kind of centrist argument to make. Centrist is a big word this week. I don't know why I just looked it up, but of any kind of argument to try to make it. You don't have to do that as a city leader, because there's so many other city leaders that are being really great at stepping up and saying, we're not you and we're not doing that. So I don't know where this is coming from. And it's a bummer, because we were supposed to be this like really powerful city that could lead in a different way. And same with California, if we want to talk about state of the state, because I think too, like, this is Gavin Newsom's second state of the state, and the state of the state is not so good.
Yeah. I mean, this was really interesting. Matt Levin, friend of the show, who does the California Housing Crisis podcast out of Sacramento with Liam Dillon of the LA Times. So Matt Levin was saying that this was a remarkable state of the state, this being similar to the State of the Union address that the president gives, but for California specifically. The governor, Gavin Newsom, did that this Wednesday, I want to say, this past Wednesday, and he spent a huge amount of his time talking about homelessness.
It was the word mentioned most, I think, said, someone who did like an analysis of the text.
Gavin Newsom loves to talk, so it was probably a lot of mentions for homelessness. But what Levin was saying was that to an extent, you could take away from the state of the state that Gavin Newsom has staked the success or failure of his first term as governor of California on the ability of the state to tackle this specific issue, being the homelessness crisis. That is remarkable. It's very different from, I would say, where we were at even a year ago. I mean,
remember when a year ago he declared that high speed rail was not happening?
Was dead.
Yeah. RIP to HSR.
And you know what? He was right.
Still being built, Scott. It's still under construction.
But so here we are a year later. And I mean, you've been here for 19 years?
Yeah, 19 years.
Has there ever been a point in time where you feel like homelessness was like the statewide top priority in the time that you've been here?
No.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, it's kind of shocking. I feel like it has really, over the course of the past year, towards the end of like 2019, it just sort of became, I maybe just politicians realized that it was the issue that was inescapable.
Because it finally started affecting their actual constituents. I'm doing quote unquote that are mad that people have RVs on their street.
Right.
Which, by the way, we got some RVs in LA this week.
Speaking of,
I think we got 10 RVs.
Yeah. And where are they? Federal government.
Well, they can't park anywhere on the streets. So I don't know where they are. They're probably impounded. Yeah. They're from the state government.
Yeah.
They're from Gavin's house to our house.
And you have mentioned in the past that this is an interesting policy because the RVs, the availability of the RVs was not the issue.
Yeah.
People
can get RVs.
People had RVs, but they didn't have anywhere that they could park them.
No safe parking.
Without being in danger of being impounded.
They could get impounded or towed, And we wrote this like gut-wrenching story on Curbed that we published about what it feels like to have somebody come and tow your RV away with literally your whole life in it. And like, this happens every day. And they send some new RVs, I guess, you can park them at the mayor's office.
They had one specific location that I noticed that they were like, okay, we're going to park these here. God knows. I mean,
like Caltrans property, I think, is one of the places up
right.
north.
Right. Which is like, what would even be the process of getting into one of those 10 units?
Yes. The waiting list is
absurd scene, I'm sure. Yeah. So anyway, the governor talked a lot about homelessness in his state of the state. One of the big upshots, you may remember from an earlier episode, we talked about how the state was putting out a homelessness task force that included former Sacramento mayor and former assembly speaker Daryl Steinberg, as well as locally Mark Ridley Thomas, who is currently running for the city council District 10 seat vacated by Herb Wesson. That task force provided a recommendation that the state should be allowed to sue any city that is not doing enough to get housing for their homeless population. So Gavin Newsom in his State of the State rejected that proposal, but he did say...
Didn't also Gavin Newsom say he was going to do that when he first got into office?
He wanted to sue for...
They sued Huntington Beach.
They sued Huntington Beach, not
for that specifically, not for
homeless housing, but for...
Why wouldn't it be the same thing? Like, that seems like a similar recourse that you could take.
I don't understand. First of all, never task force anything. We are beyond task force. That is not an appropriate arena from which to make these kind of decisions. They are never regarded by the people who actually have power with any kind of...
Well, didn't they create like a task force within the task force then? They had like a... Yeah,
no, that
they
sounds had like painfully a super likely.
Task. I mean...
A super task force.
We're beyond.
Yeah, we are beyond the help of a task force. Daryl Steinberg, by the way, I just want to shout him out for when he was at the USC conference the other week about homelessness. He was talking about wanting to have, as politicians have been doing a lot lately, wanting to have the ability to, if it came to it, criminalize or enter into conservatorship individuals who are living on the street.
Right.
And he used a phrase that was so particular. I really hope that this does not catch on. He said that we need, instead of saying that we need to have a carrot and stick approach, he said that we needed to have a hard carrot available to not a stick, it's a hard carrot.
What does that mean?
It means that you're giving people what...
Just giving them what they want.
You're not giving them what they
you're
want.
You're not giving what they want.
You are hitting them with the hard carrot.
Oh, a hard carrot.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think so, after my fridge...
You don't like it,
my
right?
fridge drama, I just can only think of, like...
Rotting vegetables.
Carrots. Yeah, I mean that. All right, let's not hit anyone with carrots or... other vegetables.
Before we move off the topic of homelessness, though, there was a very large story that came out, a profile by Ben Oreskes in the LA Times.
So good.
Came out this week, and this was from a 24-hour period that he spent over last summer at fire station number 9. This is LAFD, LA Fire Department. This is the station that is located on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. Covers a 1.2 square mile area and receives 30,000 calls a year. Absolutely breathtaking storytelling by Ben Oreskes, who has, of course, been on the show with Doug Smith. We talked to him about the demographics of the homeless count. I really recommend going back and listening to that episode. It deals a lot with how the once per year homeless count might miss certain mental illnesses and things like that individuals are dealing with, particularly like things like post-traumatic stress disorder. But the current profile, it is really wild.
Yeah. And to say that if you want to see like the way that we're wasting money as a city by not housing our people who need housing, this gives you all the information that you need, because they're going out. It's very expensive for them to transport people to medical help or to literally put out fires in some case. There's all these dangerous situations, and it would be very easy to avoid a lot. Some of them are not that dangerous. Some of them are just things that firefighters are getting called in to do, which is what happens for things all over the city. But you really do start to see how it adds up and how we're spending so much money on these emergency services just to keep people alive in some cases. It doesn't need to be that way.
This to me, when I'm reading this, and it mirrors kind of what Oreskes says is the way that the firefighters think of themselves. When you're reading it, it is akin directly to war zone reporting.
Yes, that's what it feels
like. So similar to that. For anybody who hasn't read it so far, first of all, really recommend that you read this piece.
And the photos
are heartbreaking.
Yes.
So the firefighters, they work in shifts that are potentially days long, et cetera. They stay at the station. Right. They maybe start at 4 a.m. They're beginning to arrive. They need to get everything ready because the volume of calls is so high. They're dealing with, you know, tens of thousands more calls per year than any other station in LA for this 1 square mile area. They get in, and then immediately the calls start coming in, and they're dealing with overdoses. They're dealing with, at one point, they find somebody who, or they're called to respond to somebody who has fallen out of a high window and has like broken just like every bone in their body, basically. There are fires, but they're vastly right. outnumbered by the medical calls that they receive. Yeah. And yeah, they describe it as being like a mentality of being, you know, sort of like being a medic in a war zone. And yeah. and how do you process those things that you're seeing? There is one, there's one particular comment that is made or anecdote that is told by the senior firefighter on duty there about his first day on the job that is just like, this storytelling, as far as it's just like somebody who is being, who was homeless and is basically being like eaten alive by bugs
yeah.
on the street. Like you kind of, this is kind of like the reason why we do this show, right? Like you don't need to, if you have concerns about the human condition and you have concerns about the state of society or the world or whatever, you do not need to go outside of LA at all.
No.
You could not find more horror, you know, more concentrated hardly anywhere on earth than what we have in our backyard yes. in this extremely, you know, opulent downtown area, just embedded there. And God, it is hard to grapple with.
And the thing I was thinking too, and I actually had to stop reading it at one point because it was just too much at the moment. And so you have like trained professionals, paramedics, firefighters mm-hmm. who are supposed to know how to deal with this stuff out there. So then imagine being just someone who lives there and yeah. how traumatic it would be to just experience this day in and day out yeah. and have no way to escape or get out or have a place to live. And it's really important that the LA Times keeps doing these stories with this perspective that you cannot look away. Like we can no longer look away. And I'm totally. So appreciative of them for doing this. And this is a must read. And I hope it changes someone's mind, someone out there in a position of power or a position of influence in some way, because we can no longer look away. And this is evidence of not just the physical impact, but the financial impact yeah. it's just makes no sense to let people continue to live like this.
Totally. This could be like a beat unto itself. Yes. Like it's really
just every just week 24 hours from like a different and it's like fire station.
It's easy to forget too, because like you were saying, now homelessness is being noticed by the constituents that politicians actually care about. Yeah. But it's easy to forget that a big part of the reason why we're seeing this increase in visible homelessness is because a lot of people that were formerly living on Skid Row, and I've heard this from people that I've talked to, I know that Hayes has mentioned it as well, are saying Skid Row has gotten way more dangerous mm-hmm. and there are way more narcotics on the street, and there are way more people who are violent and abusive, and it's just gotten more dangerous to be homeless on Skid Row. But the thing is, like, when we treat it as just like that's not news because it's Skid Row right. and like these people are living in conditions that we don't have to think about because right. it's Skid Row, that's how we get to the situation yeah. that we're in, right? Yeah. Like that's how we get here. So right. if we want to get out of this position, we have to, like you said, we have to stop treating it like something that we can look away from.
Three people a day die because of these situations, and it could be avoidable. On to something you can do about it, which is something we've been talking about here on the show a lot. Voting.
It's voting
has time. Started. It's voting
it's
time.
It's voting time. Yeah. It's a 10-day voting period now. It's never going to end.
And you voted. Yeah. And you voted already. You have voted.
Yeah, I did.
Did you wear your sticker?
I did wear my, so that was the only thing.
I know, that's kind of a bummer. Like, I think I'm still going to wear it on election day just for fun.
Every day?
Yeah, every day. Keep changing it. Or they could make like pins instead. You could pin it.
I like that idea.
So if you got your ballot in the mail, it does have a sticker on it. Thank God. Because that was what my children were most worried about. Where is the sticker?
Yeah.
They really like to go vote with me. So I think I probably will still go take them with me to vote. Maybe even on election day because it's fun.
It is fun.
But there'll probably be fewer people doing it on election day.
Yeah. So we put up our voter guide. First of all, it took us a long time.
Because we also made a website.
We also made a website to go with it.
It's not just a voting website, but it has.
Well, I mean, all aspects of it took a long time, honestly. I feel like whenever anybody has to deal with all three of us together, it makes it take like 6 months longer than otherwise. But we got it out. If you want to look at our voter guide, it is at thelapot.com. And we talked a bit about some of our like more... if not contentious, some of the more actively contested races that we thought were a little bit closer on last week's episode. If you want to go back and listen to that to get our choices, otherwise the full set of picks are all online now. But yeah, so one of the big things about this particular election is that we in LA County, and is this also just like everywhere in the state, right? Or just,
no, I think it's just LA County.
Okay, so we in LA County are putting together a new way to vote, and it's live now, so you'll see it if you go to your voting center currently. Instead of the old system where you had a polling place that you would go to and you had a paper ballot that you would mark, like a little scantron that you would mark with that marker, now it is all digital. So you're going to be, well, I shouldn't say all digital. Basically, the setup is you get a piece of paper that is your ballot and you insert into a machine. Then you're going to use a touchpad to like make your selections, and then it prints back out your ballot at the end, and then you submit it into a receptacle that will it. So the paper ballot is still what's being counted, but the interface is all digital now.
But I was going to say, weren't there some issues? I was seeing some problems on the first day.
Yeah, there were. I actually wasn't planning on going to vote yesterday, but Hayes texted us and he was saying that he was like, he made it sound very bad.
Yeah. I will just say. I guess I'm like Iowa caucus vibes.
Yeah, he made it sound very bad. But so the Silver Lake JCC, which was the closest voting center to me anyway, Hayes was saying that he had heard reports that people were being turned away. Wasn't sure why or what was going on, but it seemed like there were major really issues. Yeah. So I was very interested. I was like, okay, I'm just going to take my ballot. I'm going to go do this now. I went over there and I didn't encounter any problems. It turned out, though, what happened at the JCC, as well as at least a handful of other locations across the county.
Yeah, there were some stories
on this, yeah. In order to turn on the machines, you need an access code or password.
1, 2, 3, 4.
And it seems like a lot of the volunteers or even the poll workers who were there didn't have those access codes when they first booted up the machines.
So that seems okay. That seems innocent.
It is innocent. It seems like a major oversight to not be able to turn on your machines. But at the same time, I was there by, 10:30. So they had opened...
Just like the real eager beavers were the ones who had to
7 a.m.
Yeah, you were there at
7 a.m.
on a Saturday.
First day that voting started.
Why were you doing that?
Listen, you were trying to be conscientious.
Ask yourself some other questions.
You were trying to be conscientious. We get it. Or maybe you were just bird dogging and hoping that everything was a total shit show, which seems incredibly possible too. Yeah. By the time I got there at 10:30, a couple hours after opening, they had things figured out and it was running very smoothly.
Great.
So I did post on my Twitter feed just sort of like a walkthrough of what it looks like as you're doing this. Or if you want a much better version of what I did not know this existed. The LA Times has an incredible video.
So good.
It's really funny and extremely informative. It talks about this change, why it's happening, and what voting is going to look like going forward. All in all, you haven't gone yet, but I think it's working well.
I think there's two things that people need to think about when, you might be able to vote very easily, but you might not be able to vote. You might not be able to leave work. You might not have accessibility issues when it comes to physically getting to the places. So just opening up these voting centers for an extended amount of time will hopefully get more people to actually vote, increase our turnout, things like that. But one important thing to know is that your polling place that you've gone to might not be one of these new polling places. So mine actually is. Mine's the same. So, but there are other ones that have been closed or they couldn't accommodate it for you know, the entire period of time. So there, but there's still lots of them and there's lots of places, and you can also still mail in your ballot. Everybody got a mail-inable ballot, mail ballot. And you could also just take the mail-in ballot to the polling place before the time, right? If you feel like you want to do it that way. And you can also go vote in some really cool places. I think that's another thing people have been saying, like you could vote at the Hollywood Bowl.
The Beverly Center. Yeah,
pick a place that you just want to go to and just go hang out for a while. And like I was coming back through Union Station. I was like, oh, I could go vote somewhere, like, you know, I could go anywhere. I could take transit and like find like the most transit accessible place to vote, you know, with that. So I was, you know, you can get creative. Yeah.
You should do that, and we can put it up on the website. Yeah. I mean, so we talk a lot about, I think that the state legislature, we talk about like positive things that we're doing here in California. But one of the things that happens a lot is we are very critical of the county, I think for good reason. But this actually seems like a positive change, making, this is substantively, I would say, making voting a lot more accessible to a lot more people. Obviously, we should wait until the end of the voting period before we, you know, start saying, hooray, we did it. But but it does seem like these changes, allowing voting for an 11-day period, it is a good idea.
Yeah.
And allowing these long hours, making voting accessible to people whom it might otherwise not have been, it is a markedly different direction than a lot of the country is taking right now. So kudos to LA County for that.
We'll see how it goes. Fingers crossed. I think it'll be okay. I'm not worried. The paper like receipt thing is good. Like I feel like that's really important. I think that
it made me feel a lot more comfortable about it. Feel better. It does look like it's going into a little trash can in the back.
Oh well, aren't they all?
Hopefully,
isn't
not.
That what our vote is? Really, the most symbolic. So speaking of receipts, LACMA.
That's good. That was really good.
A story we've talked about a lot. We've got a museum that wants to mount a county-owned museum, by the way, a county, you know, that paid for with county tax dollars, wants to expand. And it's looking like those numbers are not maybe going to balance out. Tell us more. Written an article by a friend of the show who's talked about LACMA here, Carolina Miranda. What did she write about?
So Carolina had a story that was excellent this week. She has been covering the LACMA expansion plans for a while. I call it an expansion, although as we've discussed on the show before, it doesn't actually result in a lot more display space for the existing collection. LACMA, like you mentioned, the campus that they have there at Wilshire and Fairfax. It's a collection of buildings from across a number of different decades, I feel like. And what they want to do is build this new Peter Zumthor oil slick little design. I believe that's what Carolina's called it.
The oil slick is now gone. Now it's just like a beige slick.
It's a beige slick. I don't even know what you would call that. But it just drifts.
Freeway overpass.
Drifts lazily over Wilshire. And the county has been desperately trying to find people who want to fund this thing for a long time. Carolina's new story is all about the way that it's currently proposed to be funded and how much it is going to cost relative to the county's existing the museum rather's existing assets. This is a pretty eye-opening story, I felt like, because she compares the state of LACMA to MoMA, which also had a major expansion in recent years, took on a bunch of debt to do it. But MoMA in New York has a huge endowment and a lot of very valuable assets. Whereas LACMA has an endowment of, I believe she says, like 130 something million dollars.
There's an endowment, but there's also a great deal of debt, county bond debt. So we've got all these other expansions that they've done in recent years. And you have to think about, even like in the years that I've lived here, LACMA has built like several new buildings, and that doesn't even count the Motion Picture Academy one on the corner, which is part of the campus. They have accrued quite a bit of debt building those buildings, even though they've been paid for by people like Eli Broad and the Resnicks. So it's not always working out, the math.
The question I think that Carolina is posing, that a number of other writers have posed, is this actually in the best interest of the museum? And I think there are, at this point, there are very good questions that are raised in this piece about whether or not LACMA can actually afford the amount of debt that it is attempting to take on at that present. It doesn't have enough funding to actually complete construction. But despite that,
they're already starting to tear it up. They're already like gutting.
They're
like
gutting the Pereira buildings. The older buildings. And then, but then they're also about to begin the demolition process, yeah. Right?
I mean, right now, I think what it looks like is they're doing like the pre-demolition, like they're pulling out things that are like, could be toxic or, you know, mm-hmm. there's all this part. But, you know, there's still groups that are trying to stop this. There's still right. groups that are trying to make arguments that the buildings can be saved in some way. Sam Lubell, a great architecture writer who used to live here and now lives in New York, wrote this really wonderful op-ed also on the LA Times, using MoMA as an example, right. as a place that was able to preserve or keep or use a lot of the older elements that didn't maybe work quite as well for showing art while kind of knitting together a new campus that was more relevant to the changing neighborhood and to how people use the museum, which is not always to go see art, right? And I don't think we've seen any of that vision from this latest chapter of LACMA. And no. and even around it, we haven't talked about this before, but the tar pits, the Natural History Museum campus of the tar pits, right. the Liberty tar pits that are right there, Page Museum, they've undergone a wonderful mm-hmm. example of tapping three firms to compete and bring this very sensitive look to what this should be over the next, you know, whatever, you know, age we're in. I don't know the Anthropocene is. But to kind of bring the tar pits into the next century, millennium.
Yeah.
And I think you see this really thoughtful process of how design connects a place to the city and what its role is. And we don't have any of that thinking from the Zimtor building at all. And people have even like complained about it. And then they like give more new reasons about why it actually is like a cool idea. And what Sam points out, I think so well in his story is that, you know, this idea that you just raise everything and build something new and sparkly is actually the old idea, right? Like this, the new idea would be, let's try to keep this in some way.
It does seem, it's very like 1960s LA. We're just going to tear it down and build something
Bunker
new in its
Hill
place.
Syndrome.
The ambassador, like any of these like things, right? I mean, what is driving this process at this point? It seems like it has reached this level where it's unstoppable. Like it just is going to keep moving forward no matter what, no matter what comes out about it. Caroline Miranda in this piece compares the current plan that, so the current plan basically allows for the museum to borrow up to $300 million from the county, which Carolina compares to paying two mortgages on your house at one time.
Two mortgages on your house when your one house is suffering a severe homelessness crisis and you actually maybe shouldn't be buying or building a second house. Just putting that out there.
It's wild, but it seems like regardless of what happens, the political class is firmly behind this proposal. And I don't understand why, really. Do you like what are we getting out of this that is so like unassailable? I just don't get it.
I think this is the same problem that plagues probably most institutions that are like LACMA. It's driven by, in this case, it seems like just one person's vision for what they think. Michael Govan, who's the LACMA director, that just his vision for what this should be, and picking a person to design it who has no real ties to LA or sensitivities to what we're facing here. And showing kind of a very clear disdain almost for our history and our neighborhoods. And then you've got things like, remember when they went to the county to ask for the money and like Brad Pitt and Diane Keaton like showed up. And so you've got this like celebrity sheen. And I think like, you know, you saw at the Oscars how they had like a big promo about the museum, that Motion Picture Academy museum that they're building there too. And it's all this like getting caught up in, this is going to be, it's going to be the most amazing, but yet not even providing adequate places for people to cross wheelchair to like experience things.
Right.
Like,
it's very...
not even thinking about this whole area as like a public space for people to use. And that should be the primary goal of a place like LACMA.
It's very slapdash. I mean, it's like, it's so weird. Like you have $1 billion building that you're building and it's like this, we haven't even considered where people are going to cross the street. Who cares?
I mean, of course not.
It seems
because if you're not crossing through the building and paying whatever it is, $20 to go to the museum,
It does seem like
you just have to run across Wilshire.
At the very strangely, I'm in the place of having now brought up HGTV twice on this episode. But it's like if you were watching like House Hunters, like the Board of Supervisors is like the couple who like wants to buy something that is so far out of their price range, and they're just like, "We'll just eat ramen for the next 10 years."
And I don't think they really, in that conversation or in subsequent ones, they're not really saying that there is anything wrong with this.
No.
And that's what I think. And I do understand too. I mean, we've had a lot of architecture critics. I've written a story. People have written, you know, people are kind of criticizing the thing. But the problem is a lot of the artists won't criticize it because they too want their work to be shown and, you know, acquired by. And so it creates a very complicated relationship with this problem, you know, because people just the right people aren't probably going to speak out about it who will be most impacted by this. But it is a public building. It is belongs to us. Like, we should keep making fusses about it. And sure. I don't know what is going to happen now, but
the proposals to like stop or redirect this effort or the redirect of the redesign have been completely steamrolled. Like you said, they've already started.
Yeah, like they came and spoke at those meetings at the county supervisor hearings and they were just like,
It is very similar to a number of other cases that you can bring up from LA history, but the ambassador being one of them, where it's just like, this is just going to happen. It seems like a slow rolling disaster. And then forever afterward, people are going to be like, why did this happen?
Right. But the money argument actually seems like a good one. So hopefully people can start to pay attention to the fact that they actually don't have the money to, unless, as I was saying to someone else, that maybe Brad Pitt, now that he got won an Oscar, maybe he will like
melt his Oscar down and sell it.
And then they can build the museum and name it the Brad Pitt Museum.
That would be wonderful.
The Brad Pitt County Museum. Thank you, Brad Pitt.
Okay. That is our show for this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. This is LA Podcast. We'll be back next week. Bye. LA Podcast. LA Podcast on a hell.